Welcome, listeners, to the latest episode of Out of Left Field. As usual, we are podcasting from the Gulag Archipelago of Soviet Kanakistan, otherwise known as beautiful Victoria, British Columbia, Vancouver Island. I'm your co-host, Ben. With us, as always, is Mac.
Yeah, I'm the other co-host.
And we have a special guest today, Victoria City Councilor since 2014, Jeremy Loveday. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on today.
So we're going to talk about municipal issues, municipal politics. Jeremy Loveday, for those of you outside of Victoria, is a notoriously progressive figure in the municipal scene and has brought many a progressive piece of legislation to the Victoria City Council. And I think you mentioned you're also on the central, what is it, CRD?
The CRD, the Capital Regional District.
Capital Regional District. So, just quickly, if you want to support the show, even a dollar or two per month on Patreon helps. Follow us on Twitter at RealOolf. And we are part of a broader podcast network of left-wing Canadian podcasts called the Ricochet Podcast Network, which you can find at www.ricochet.media. Without further ado, let's start at the beginning. Jeremy, how did you get yourself involved in municipal politics?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on today. I've always been political. Ever since I was a teenager, I was involved in activism at the grassroots level, working on whether it be anti-corporate culture campaigns or international solidarity movements, and found that it was hard to get anything concrete accomplished. And then over time, I realized that the issues I was working on were more local, sometimes even at the neighborhood level, and then started a program with the city called the Youth Poet Laureate Program. So I'm a spoken word artist, and that was saw the power of young people speaking their truth and wanted to give them that platform. And so I came to the city with that idea and actually was able to get it done. And to me, that it was like a light bulb turning on, telling me that, okay, the local level is where you can actually get stuff done. And from there, I started looking at the city and started talking about running. And everybody told me I wouldn't win. And so I knocked on every door in the city to prove them wrong.
So I guess the question I'd have is, you said that like municipal politics is sort of, I guess, a bit more easy to engage with. Like it's a place you can actually, as you said, get things done. What role do you think municipal politics should have or does have?
Should have and does have are potentially different. I think that cities are more important than ever and will continue to become more important. The challenges we face as a society are immense, whether that be a climate crisis or the housing crisis, all the opioid deaths. And the responses to those things need to be based in the communities where the harm is actually occurring. And I think that's where the solutions will come from too. And so I think that as we look at like climate crisis, for example, good percentage of the emissions in this world come from either buildings or transportation, both of which are actually in the jurisdiction of municipalities. And when we see more and more downloading from provincial and federal governments, we're in a place where we need to be taking action to address these crises and the other needs of our residents, but we don't have the funds to do it. And so more and more, we need to work with the social movements, the ecological justice movements. And I think the way we're going to get that done is at the municipal level by working with the grassroots.
So I guess as kind of an extension to that question in terms of like, you know, the problems that we face exist on a municipal level, like in the cities that we live in and the streets that we walk on every day. How do you think local politics, like at the municipal level, can actually be that catalyst for getting people involved and to affect change? And do you have any examples in your kind of career as a city councilor of examples of that?
One of the things that I've noticed, and it's from my own experience, but also the experience of others that I've witnessed through working with activist organizations and other community groups. And to me, that's the only way I've been able to get anything done is by working alongside social movements. And so one thing that I've noticed is that by tackling issues at the local level, we've actually been able to get some things done. And those wins are rare for activist organizations and many community groups.
Yeah,
and
so tell me about it.
And so to be able to give people not only a sense that they can create change, but actually be able to see that change enacted, I think it's empowering. And I think it allows people to feel that sense of solidarity so that they can move on to the next issue. And so I've seen that as a concrete example of the momentum that can be built. And look forward to more.
Could you give any examples of some wins that you've had with social movements in the city?
Yeah, basically anything that I've gotten done has been working in conjunction with community-based organizations. So for example, last term, we brought in a moratorium on the demolition of rental properties while we developed policies to help protect renters, and that including a tenant assistance policy for people who are being evicted because of rezonings. And so with that, the only way we were able to do that is by filling the council chambers full of renters. And then a lot of those people ended up working on the next municipal campaign. And we saw the biggest renters vote movement that we've ever seen municipally here. And that ended up electing a progressive council. And so, I mean, that's very reductionist, but there's a thread there that I think is important. And it's been the same for everything. When we moved to put in bike lanes, for example, there was a huge movement of active transportation activists who filled the council chambers and who had a really fun bike ride to City Hall and circled around City Hall. And it's a great memory of mine to see everybody out to support it. And I think it's an amazing feeling to come down to your local government and be able to speak and then actually have that acted upon. So often we, you know, as a city councilor, I so often hear from people when they're complaining about stuff and when things aren't going well, that's when people tend to speak up. But I think at the municipal level, just a few voices can really start to make a difference. And I think when people start knowing that within themselves, they're going to speak up more.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of putting it, because I agree with you. I think that's the way things should be done. But it is so rare to find that kind of like obvious social movement with a sort of elected political component kind of coming together like that. I can't really think of anything like that on any other like provincial or federal level where that really happens all that often. But yeah, it seems like on a municipal level, it's a lot easier, or at least more accessible.
I think it's hard within political parties. And I think you do see some of that right now in the States, I think, with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders. I think they are working alongside grassroots movements, and you're seeing that in the success they're having right now, and in how fundamentally different the policies they're espousing are from the policies of the rest of the Democratic Party. And I think that's what people want. I think people want social and ecological justice. And I think they just need to hear those ideas every day realize that the exploitation and the violence that is incumbent in the system that we're a part of right now isn't normal. And what is could be the new normal is having everybody have a better shot.
You mentioned how... Well, firstly, I think the Democratic establishment are absolutely terrified right now, which is I'd love to see. But you mentioned earlier about how you know inspiring it is to be able to actually have an issue and elect someone to address that issue and have it done. And I mean, this is supposed to be how our democracy actually works. So it's, you know, kind of disconcerting and upsetting that the normal is that you feel, you know, just kind of stymied all the time. And I'm no stranger to this. Before I moved to Victoria, I grew up in the Okanagan, and federally, my member of parliament was Stockwell Day. And so, you know, my parents are NDP voters, and, you know, they would just, every election was just so demoralizing because they knew that they weren't going to win. They would go to the polls and vote NDP because that's what you do. But every single time, Stockwell Day won, and he was like the most foaming at the mouth, insane politician in the entire country at the time. And it's like, what are we even doing this for? So it's really refreshing here in Victoria. Not only, I mean, federally, we have Laurel Collins as the NDP representative, and she's great. And honestly, I think that all of you on the city council are doing a really awesome job. So just kind of to expand on that, what do you think the biggest challenges facing Victoria are and other municipalities across, you know, British Columbia and Canada? I'm thinking specifically things like, you know, lack of healthcare, doctor shortages, expensive tuition, expensive rents, and also how a lot of the biggest issues that we're facing in Victoria are kind of provincial jurisdiction and federal jurisdiction. Could you elaborate on how you feel, I guess, like what do you think the biggest problems are, and in what ways do you feel frustrated by problems that are systemic, that are just beyond municipal control? And on the other hand, how do you think that municipal governments can actually kind of make meaningful change to address those problems that are not within our jurisdiction?
The issue of jurisdiction is one that's both settled by the Constitution, but also totally blurry because of downloading by the provincial and federal government over the past number of decades. And municipalities and local governments have had to step up into realms of policy that were not traditionally seen as municipal jurisdiction, but were totally abdicated by upper levels of government. So local governments have had to step in. I think housing is a great example. We don't have the money to solve the housing crisis, but if our jurisdiction isn't stepping up constantly and saying we want to partner, you know, we're looking, like, for example, as a city right now, we're looking to buy land for housing. And, you know, that's not a step that the city of Victoria has taken in the past. But once we have that land, the province is much more likely to come on and pay for the actual building. And so those types of partnerships are much more likely to get off the ground if you have a willing local government that is going to step up and have the political will to follow through a rezoning that could potentially be quite acrimonious, for example.
Yeah, in Victoria, at least, I've lived here my whole life and all that. All I'll say is, like, yeah, we're very acrimonious about everything. Nothing gets done just sort of without a lot of people being rather annoyed about anything at all.
No matter what you want to do, it's there's always some group of people sometimes that throws a temper tantrum about it.
And change is hard, you know. And,
sure.
And
I get it.
And I think there's a lot more people who are participating now locally that traditionally haven't participated, that are voices for change, which I think is a positive thing.
No, I think the direction is, you know, moving in a better one. The fact that we actually got bike lanes put in is something I would have probably considered somewhat unimaginable not that long ago, yeah, just because of how obstructionist a lot of the politics is. Not because people just hate everything, but because there's always this, there's an attitude, I think, that kind of seeps into a lot of things where it's like, well, if we just do nothing, then we don't make anyone mad.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a pretty compelling kind of idea, I guess.
Yeah, if you go whichever way the wind's blowing, you'll probably get reelected forever. You know, but what positive impact will you be making on an everyday basis,
yeah,
while you're filling that seat? And I don't want to be elected to, fill a seat. I'm there to make change.
Get your name with a couple of years on a plaque somewhere, and that's the...
As a city councilor, you don't even get a plaque, so it's no point unless you're there to make change. But looking at if a jurisdiction doesn't step up to the plate,
yeah,
you look at Oak Bay. They have actually, their most recent survey I saw showed that they actually have declining population and no affordable housing.
Yeah, it was about a year and a half ago, I think, but they pointed out that over sort of the last period of 10 years or so, the number of rental properties in Oak Bay has actually gone down even though the demand is gone up and the population of Victoria as a whole has gone up, and the number of renters, at least in Oak Bay, they're pointing out, has not gone down that much, but the like they're just losing, they're just not actually building anything for anyone there.
No, I mean, they've been talking about, I hate to throw them under the bus, but I guess that's what I'm doing. They've been talking about putting in garden suites for like decades, it seems. Yeah. And, you know, that's a...
duplex variants and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. It's just weird. And I mean, to be fair, that is like... Again, I guess that's sort of the alternate argument for why, like, municipal politics. On the one hand, it's very easy and accessible. On the other hand, it's also, like, very personal and easily, like, a lot of personal offenses can happen where it's like a person doesn't want their neighborhood to change, and that's, in principle, any change to a city is going to change a neighborhood, so why don't we just keep everything as it is now? And I do think, on the whole, that's sort of been the Oak Bay attitude, is just, let's just keep our town like it is now.
Well,
forever.
While we're throwing Oak Bay under the bus,
they don't listen to podcasts.
Yeah,
so who cares?
No, they're way too old for that. But I mean, it reminds me of when it was a recent election. I'm not sure if it was the last one, but you know, the rest of the city was dealing with the opioid crisis and the housing crisis and you know, all sorts of issues. And the defining issue for the Oak Bay election was whether or not to cull the deer population. For Christ's sake, like, come on.
Well, it's an important question. I think we need to do more work about teaching these deer how to use the crosswalks. Like, some of them understand how they work, but not enough of them.
Education is important.
And you know, well, just to kind of extrapolate on the whole housing question, which I think is probably, let's be honest, it's the defining issue for not just Victoria, but like basically like most lots of municipalities in Canada. It's just soul crushing, right? You tabled something in City Hall to crack down on illegal short-term rentals, which is, you know, artificially deflating the amount of long-term rentals on the market. Can you tell us a bit about that and what effect you think it will have?
Yeah, so I see the short-term vacation rental issue as one pretty small piece of the puzzle, but an important one. As you said, it's taking hundreds of units out of the housing stock that should be used as homes that are currently being used as part-time hotels and without any sort of regulation. So what we did was we brought in a new zoning bylaw for the whole downtown, downzoned the whole downtown, so that vacation rentals couldn't be in new buildings, essentially. If they were already operating, unfortunately, the way the provincial law works is that they're grandparented in, so they're allowed to stay if they get business licenses. But we set business license fees at not high enough to be a deterrent necessarily, but to enough to pay for the enforcement. So we set those fees at high enough rates that we could hire bylaw officers, and that's the most recent action, is to hire new bylaw officers to actually proactively enforce, to make sure the ones that aren't in compliance and don't have business licenses will be brought into compliance, so that those units can be homes again. And that means, so for example, in the traditional neighborhoods, there's not many places at all that can have legal Airbnbs. You can rent out a room in your house, but you can't rent out a whole suite. And there's, because of a weird zoning thing, much of downtown at one point all had transient accommodation zoning, and now that's taken away, but some of them will still be able to because they already operated.
And I mean, that's another example of where the provincial and municipal responsibilities and laws are at loggerheads, right? Where we want to do this thing, we want to outlaw short-term rentals probably across the board, with the exception of maybe a room and a house, but then, well, sorry, you can't do that because the province says so. Too bad. Whoops.
Yeah, it is sort of strange, again, like you said earlier about the, like, there is a constitution and it clearly defines the roles of everything in principle, but the actual, decisions made or like, especially when, I mean, this all kind of comes down to funding one way or another, is, as you said, offloaded onto the municipality, so that it's like, you don't have the money to solve the housing crisis, but you also don't have the power to stop things that are exacerbating the housing crisis either, in many cases.
Yeah, and even, you know, there's even differences between jurisdictions. For example, Vancouver has the Vancouver Charter. So when they take different actions for housing or the environment, I often hear from people saying, can you do that in Victoria? And, you know, after consulting, you know, either my own knowledge or with the city's lawyer, the answer is often no, we don't have the legal authority. And then we're forced to try to take it to the province and ask them to make those changes. And an example of that is the Vancouver has the empty homes tax.
Right.
And I've been pushing for 4 odd years to have the ability for other municipalities to bring in an empty homes tax if they would like. And, you know, you don't have to go far to see buildings where at night there's not many lights on in the evening. And that's,
well, there's, you know, there's one down just down the road from
about
here.
About 5 minutes down the road, our favorite piece of Stalinist architecture in the city, View Towers, where, I mean, that's, there's probably a few hundred vacant units in that building, and they are owned by the same notorious, dare I say, slumlords. Am I is that going to tarnish your reputation?
You said it, not me.
Yeah, okay. The very same landlords from the leaky condo scandal in Richmond from, you know, 10 odd years ago. And they're just empty. Like, they're, I mean, yeah. That's probably arguably one of the most affordable buildings in the whole city. And they're just not renting out new units. And they're just kind of waiting for everyone to leave. And it feels like, you know, it feels like there's nothing the city can really do about it.
There actually is nothing the city can do about it, other than, you
tell
know,
people, I guess, about it. I don't know.
Yeah, you can expropriate. That's the only power the city has. If there's a, we can't force someone to rent out units that they're holding.
I'm sorry. Did you just say the E word? Expropriate.
That's the only.
Could the city actually do that?
The city has the legal authority to expropriate property for a service that they have.
That sounds pretty good.
So, like, you look at Vancouver. They did recently purchase properties from notorious slumlords that were SROs that were really run down and not providing the people who lived there with the dignity that everyone should have in their home. And so they were able to move forward with that. And they could have done it and should have done it, you know, a decade or two ago. But now those units will be safe in perpetuity, you would hope, at least now that they're in public hands.
Okay, well, hashtag expropriate View Towers. Let's get this trending, people.
So there was, well, a couple of years ago, it was actually just during the tent city at the courthouse, there was, this was a discussion that was happening within the community. It's not a discussion that the city is having, but it's a discussion that was happening in the community that looking at, okay, we have this crisis that's homelessness, crisis that is manifesting in people sleeping in tents on the courthouse lawns. And it's very visible. And now that it's visible, the government will pay more attention. That's how these things tend to work.
Yeah.
And with that, we're also looking, okay, within 4 blocks of there, there's Mount Edwards, which was totally vacant. There's 844 Johnson, which is totally vacant. And there's View Towers, which was mostly vacant. And of those buildings, when the government, when the provincial government finally had the motivation to act, they bought those buildings very quickly. They owned 844 Johnson and Mount Edwards within weeks, and nothing changed with View Towers. But there's not a willing seller there. That's why they
right. Yeah.
And I don't know what their long-term plan is. I don't know how they could be making money sitting with all the vacant units.
Yeah, I don't understand. I don't know what their scheme is. I don't know what the plan is.
There's got to be something fishy going on there.
Well, pfft, whatever.
Well, there is. I mean, they have been, I believe, renting out units again. But like if you look at that building, it also has some of the best water views of anywhere in the city, and they're protected. No one will ever build in Beacon Park. No one will ever build at that church. So that view corridor to the water is worth countless millions of dollars that they hold. So I think the speculative land value of that property is...
Oh, they're probably making money just sitting on it, like on paper. Well, yeah, it's fair, because, I mean, that is the housing market right now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just, you know, I don't mean to dwell on this too much, but there's really not... I mean, we could talk about housing all night, but one major issue that I'm noticing with the city is that because most of the real estate development is done by private real estate developers, they want to take whatever land they can get and extract as much profit and revenue from that as they possibly can. And so we see all of these luxury condos going up all over the city that very few people can actually afford to live in, you know? And so not only do we have low-income housing that it's sitting vacant, we also have the high-income housing that's also sitting vacant. You know, whenever I see, construction going on in the city, it's like, oh, great, we're building more housing, finally. This is way overdue. And then you realize, oh, it's another luxury condo that I can't afford to live in, even though I have a pretty decent job. It's really disheartening. So, I mean, do you think that, is the municipality able to get involved in building social housing? Do we just not have the money?
So I guess two things there. One, since we've had a change in council a year ago, the percentage of units that are rental versus condo has totally flipped. And when we brought in the inclusionary housing policy that said 20% of all new strata buildings had to be affordable, with that policy, and I don't know if there's a direct correlation, but it seems pretty convenient that the shift happened then, that almost every building that's coming forward now is rental. And so you switch the incentives, right? And now the incentive is, do you want to build that mix of units, or do you want to build rental housing? And we're getting way more rental housing now. So a lot of the cranes you're seeing now were approved last council term. Our council was not a council that was willing to push developers to make sure they're building housing that it meets the needs of residents. And now we have a council that is willing to push developers to make sure they're meeting the needs of residents. And I think we're seeing that shift, which I think is very positive. But that will never be a substitute for a massive investment in social housing. And I think that needs to come from all levels of government. And I do think municipalities should be at the table with that. And I'm excited that the city is finally buying land. So some municipalities have historic land banks they've been sitting on for decades and decades. Victoria, we don't have it. We're a built-out city. We don't own any land that's being unused. And so we need to buy land. And so that's what we're doing.
I saw a really interesting article in the Taiyi recently that was talking about the housing crisis in Vancouver, and it noted that a number of the golf courses in Vancouver are actually on land that's already owned by the city, and so they wouldn't have to buy any land at all. They would just have to say, you know, sorry, we don't have a golf course crisis right now, we have a housing crisis, and they could just convert that land, and Fidel would be so proud. So does the city of Victoria own any golf courses that we could reuse?
Do something with
other than golf?
We don't own any golf courses.
Nuts.
You'll have to talk to Saanich.
All right. Yeah, no, they got Cedar Hill. Yeah, yeah.
And with that, I think it's an interesting debate, because as we build out our city, we also need green space, and I think it's going to be harder and harder to get new green space as we move forward, and more people moving into the city. So, I would prefer to see a golf course turned. Maybe you get some of it as housing and some of it as park, because mm-hmm. right now it's private green space that can't be accessed by the vast majority of the public.
Right.
So if you can turn that into a public space that people can use and enjoy and have as their living room as we get more dense, I think that's important too. And so I don't see the city building on any parks. I would much rather knock down a couple single family homes around on a corridor and put up an apartment building full of, you know, affordable rental housing than I would build in a green space at this point, mm-hmm. Because we have those options available
fair
to
enough.
Us. Yeah,
that's fair.
And parking lots. Let's build on some parking
hell
lots.
Hell yeah.
Or the car dealerships that sort of are like a belt around the downtown area.
And that's where we're building the fire hall with 200 units of affordable housing on top. So it's, you know, I think that's an exciting project.
Fair enough.
A few blocks from here.
One thing I just want to ask, sort of just to, I guess, cap off the housing question, or at least try to for the moment.
Yeah.
So Victoria has become less affordable over the last 5-10 years, or however long you want to go. It's just becoming less affordable year by year by year. What do you think would be, I mean, this is sort of without reference to like the limits of municipal powers, but what do you think would be an actual solution to the housing crisis itself?
And just a quick addendum to that question. There was a article that I saw in, I think, Vic City News that cited a report showing that Victoria is the 16th most expensive city in the world to live in.
World class city.
Hong Kong is number one, and guess what? Vancouver is number two, second least affordable in the whole world. So we're up there, you know. It's
well, so's Nanaimo.
Yes, there's quite a few Canadian cities actually. So yeah, what do you think?
So I think there's no one thing that's going to do it, but I think there's a number of large actions that could be taken that could tackle this housing crisis. But the first is a fundamental shift in how we think of housing. And we need to shift from thinking of it as a commodity to thinking of it as a human right, and that every person deserves to have a home. And I think when we start to have that shift, we will then act differently when it comes to making policy and deciding what gets built. And so in terms of actual policies, I think we need, as I said, a massive investment in social housing, including reinvestment in co-op housing. I think that'll make a big difference. When you look at the percentage of housing in many European countries, for example, that is publicly owned versus privately held, their percentages are often 10 times as high as our percentage here. And I think we need to make sure that we're getting much more public housing built. I think we need rent control. I think rent needs to be tied to the unit instead of the person, so that when someone moves out, that rent isn't bumped up, sometimes $500-$600 in between tenants, because that rent will never come back down. And I think those two things in itself will be make a big difference. And then also we need to make sure that the development that's happening in the private market is working for residents. And so I think we're doing that with the inclusionary housing policy. And I think we can keep pushing that to make sure that developers, when they come forward, they're building housing units that actual residents can afford. And I guess one other piece is controlling the speculation in the housing market. And I think we have seen some success in the provincial speculation tax. And I think, you know, increasing that tax and allowing municipalities to bring in an empty homes tax will help make sure that the units of housing that are out there are actually being used as homes.
So we mentioned it earlier about like things you've done and things that have happened that are positive. The bike lanes.
Yeah.
What the hell is people's problem with the bike lanes? I just do not understand why anyone is like as psychotically just like always online obsessed with hating bike lanes as much as people have been in the city. Personally, I don't actually care about them that much. Yeah. I think they're good. They're fine. Yeah. They're bike lanes. I don't really give a shit. They're there. People are using them. So yep. They were a good idea. So done, right? But that's not enough. Apparently, they are a fundamental evil that is afflicting this city. I don't get why people are that mad about it.
I actually think there's a good portion of the public that agrees with you completely. And we hear from a loud minority on the bike lanes, and many of them don't live within the city of Victoria. They live out in Langford. They hear about it on CFAX. They drive into downtown every once in a while, and they get annoyed about the traffic. And
when there's a red light and bikes are going in front of them.
Yeah, or they think that the traffic is because of the bike lanes, and it's not. It's because we're a city now, and people are driving, and we need to be investing in public transportation instead of highways. And so there, I think that there's an equation of all these changes in the city that people might not like or that people find difficult, and they say, oh, it's the fault of the bike lanes. But really, the last bike lane we put in was Wharf to Humboldt. And I got maybe, I don't want to say a number, but very few complaints, a handful of emails. And, you know, was it a big news story for a day? Sure. But most people just said, okay, this is what we do now. And I think that's where we need to get is, okay, this is what we do now. We have a road for cars, and we've got a lane for bikes, and we also need to, you know, sidewalks that are wide enough for wheelchairs and strollers. And you just need to make sure that all different types of mobility are accommodated within city streets. And we need to stop making cars the absolute priority, and the priority is moving people.
I personally think that I have a theory on this. I think the reason why some people are, as you say, Max, psychotically angry about
and
the
they
bike
were.
Lanes.
I'm not saying they weren't. They were.
It was bizarre.
You know, Pandora Street, they were. And I think every bike lane we do gets a little, people get a little less angry. There was actually I think it was a tweet or a news story or something, and it was saying in Vancouver, and they were saying, if they put in a bike lane and no one complains, is it really a controversy?
Mm.
No, it's not. it's a little update from the city.
My theory is that motorists in particular are angry about the bike lanes for exactly the same reason that certain people are really upset about women starring in Star Wars films, in that when you are accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. You know, yeah. Like all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, there's a female Star Wars character. This is white genocide or whatever. It's like, no, I mean, you have to share the road because you know, in fact, I mean, I don't get why motorists or some of them anyway, are so, you know, pissed about it because the bike lanes help them. Like, nobody likes driving alongside a cyclist because it's dangerous for both parties. It's inconvenient for everybody. It's unsafe for everybody. And, you know, the bike lanes, they're, you know, nice and separated and pretty and well-maintained, and it gets the bikes off the street so the cars can drive, you know, unabated. I don't get it. I just think that they see, you know, a motorist and you know, our transportation network, with maybe the singular exception of buses in this city, has been completely automobile centric for, you know, since forever. And then all of a sudden, you know, a little, you know, they chip away at their, you know, the motorist privilege, and they lose their goddamn minds.
Yeah. You know, we have 230, you know, kilometers of roads or whatever it is. And like when we first had done Pandora and they were talking about, oh, and now there's bike, I was like, no, we literally took us 3 years to do 1 kilometer. Like it wasn't like we transformed. I wanted to transform the whole transportation network last term, but we didn't do it. And there was this mindset that we had actually gotten that done. And to me, that was a disappointment that we hadn't moved as fast as we thought we could. And perhaps we're a little combination of naive and ambitious with the original cycle network, but I think we'll get it done this term. And once it's done, no one's going to jackhammer it out. So even if there are people who are upset, it's there. People are using it. It's keeping people safe, and we've got to just do it.
please tell me you're going to do Cook's Treat. Please do Cook's Treat. We need to do Cook's Treat. As far as I understand, it was like the one guy that owns a bunch of businesses on that street that threw a temper tantrum and the city gave up or something.
It's close to that, but there was a number of residents who were opposed to it, as well as business owners. And then our staff came and actually said that it was would be not good for ambulance response times and other response times for emergency services. So it's still in our plan, but it's not the first one we're going to do. We're going to do Vancouver. And I think once that's done, it's still in the sort of stage three of the plan, but it's not in the next, it's not the next thing to get done.
I'm willing to be patient.
Yeah.
Just to extrapolate briefly on kind of a point that you made about the angry, loud minority, right? That is typically who we hear from about the bike lanes and other things that the city are doing. And a lot of this seems to be kind of amplified in online discourse. The Victoria BC subreddit is an absolute cesspool. In fact, I think the it was the Times Colonist at one point had to disable comments on their news articles across the board because they just got so much toxic discourse on there, and all of those people went over to Reddit and, you know,
or Facebook.
Yeah, and I've seen articles. Sure, yeah, I don't even want to go there.
They're even worse.
They're awful. Pretty bad. Awful. And you know, when you actually, I think exemplifying this is like the kind of disconnect between these two things is that, you know, people were saying how Lisa Helps is ruining the city and she's building these bike lanes and the city's not going to be recognizable anymore and this is a disaster. I can't believe she's doing this. And of course, you handily won the election. So there's this big disconnect. So, I mean, in your job, do you experience a lot of that kind of vitriol of this angry minority? How do you think that the online discourse kind of compares to the actual real world?
So I most of it is online. And, you know, there's some that's an anonymous and some that's tied to real human accounts. And that can be disheartening, for sure. You see people, anytime people are treating each other with that level of disrespect, it's hard to see. And when it's geared towards yourself, that's hard, too.
Well, I don't. An anonymous person calls me an asshole, and I don't like it. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And it's worse when you're a woman, that's for sure.
Oh,
it's
big time.
It's worse when you're a visible minority of any type, any sort of stripe. And so as a, you know, visibly someone who appears white and male, I don't get it as bad as some people. But you know, it can ruin your day every once in a while, for sure. Like most of the time it rolls off. But every once in a while, you'll wake up and you'll look in, the first thing you do in the morning is you go, you make your coffee and then you go on Twitter and you're like, oh. Right. These people are mad. Right. Okay. But then, you know, when I feel buoyed by the job is when I get to meet with people and hear their ideas and then help them bring their ideas to life. And that's most of the job, is talking to people who have, maybe they have an issue in their neighborhood and you can help fix it. Or maybe it's a bigger thing that you're pushing, a bigger policy change that people get behind. And ultimately, it was harder before the last election, because it was my first term and I hadn't run again. So it's a long, 4 years is a long time to go without an official job review. Like you imagine that in any job,
right?
You're like, well, you know, like how are people feeling? Like,
I think I'm doing okay.
Yeah. Like I'm not really working my ass off. I'm doing exactly what I said I'd do. But do people want me to continue doing it? And so after the last election, when, you know, my election results improved, I was like, okay, so there are people who are going to be upset, but ultimately I'm doing exactly what I said I'd do. And I try to have time to hear from everybody and hear all sides. I won't take feedback from an anonymous source. Mm. But anyone that wants to call me, they can call me. I read all my emails, respond to as many as I can. I'll call anybody back. So these things, like, you know, you go and it's the opposite of anonymity in this job, but you also get to have those human connections all the time, and that is worth way more than some anonymous troll.
Hmm. Yeah, good call.
I think in like 100 years or 50 years, someone will still be mad about the bike lanes. They'll be like, it'll just, whatever is Victoria looks like in the future, someone will be like in their 90s going like, you know when this city went wrong? Back when, in 2000 and whatever, you know, they did this. It's like, I don't know, whatever. Screw them.
I hope they do.
Fine. Yeah.
You look at the election, though, the three yeah. names that people, like on council, most associated with the bike lanes are Mayor Helps, Councillor Isett, and myself. And, you know, she won mayor, and then Councillor Isett and I finished first and second in the council poll. So it did not punish us at the polls.
Well, I mean, if you're not making enemies, you're not making any progress, as yeah. far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
So kind of getting back to the bigger picture here, we talked about austerity a little bit, I guess, but it's the offloading of responsibility or funding onto the cities. It didn't start with you being councillor. It didn't start really when I was even alive, probably. It's been going on for like 30 or 40 years, and it's not something unique to Victoria either, but I just wanted to ask, like, how has Victoria been trying to deal with this 30 years of austerity?
And also, like, what does it look like? Like, does the provincial government come knocking at the door and be like, hey, guys, can you pay for this?
Like, or they come in and they're like, we're going to just take all your office furniture and light bulbs because we need it for the provincial government?
No, it looks more like neglect. It looks like 30 years of no new social housing and no new co-ops since, you know, in more than 30 years. And we barely got any rental housing for decades. And so that's fine for a year or two. That's fine for maybe 3 or 4 years. You don't notice how behind you are. But after that many years, it starts to look like a crisis. And then municipalities are forced to act. And you're forced to act because when you do have that human connection, you go to the grocery store and you talk to someone in the aisle, hey, what's up? How you doing? And they tell you about how they're getting evicted and they have nowhere to live. You know, that's very personal. And so you want to help that situation. And ultimately, you don't have all the tools. So you're trying to do the best you can with the tools you have. And we're lucky now that there is money at the federal and provincial levels. Not enough, in my opinion, but it's more than we've had in many years. And so now the job of municipalities, one of the jobs is to make sure we're out there all the time saying we're ready to partner. Here's the situation here. And please come work with us to build this housing here, and we will give you a good news story, right? And that's a real thing. And then there are actions the city could take if we had ultimate political will, which is hard to come by. For example, I think all transit should be free, and we're working towards that. It's very hard to do without provincial government to partner. And, you know, we've as a first step, we brought in free transit for youth in the city of Victoria. And now we're trying to push the region to do it. And it's sort of show that it can work and then try to get that foothold in to bring in a new, essentially universal social program. And then hopefully others will get on board when you can see that it's a success story. And so that's one example of where we're taking a step into in a place that hasn't traditionally been the municipality that's done it.
I guess just to bring our non-Victoria resident listeners up to speed,
yeah.
when we say the city of Victoria,
bit complicated.
It's complicated. So the greater Victoria area is, what, 13 or 14 different municipalities?
Yeah, 13 municipalities and some, electoral areas.
Yeah, and so when we say, he's a Jeremy Loveday is a Victoria's City councillor. We actually mean the kind of downtown core,
proper Victoria,
Victoria proper.
The real Victoria,
right? But there's a bunch of other, like, what people would usually refer to as Victoria is also Saanich and Oak Bay and Langford and
Esquimalt and
And on that topic, a couple of federal elections ago, Murray Rankin from the NDP was running for a re-election. And I was standing in the lineup of the grocery store with my, Murray Rankin pin on my jacket. And buddy in front of me looks at me and sees my pin. He's like, "So, you think Murray's going to win?" I said, "Yeah, I do." And he says, "I moved to this city about 30 years ago. You want to know what the three major political debates were 30 years ago? Sewage treatment, amalgamation of the municipalities, and improved transit to the Western communities. And those are the same three issues that we're talking about today." Now, finally, through some miracle, we have actually started in the year 2019 to construct sewage treatment in this city. But other than that, and, I think we have like an extra bus lane or something to Langford, but...
Halfway.
Jesus. It really just feels like we're mostly at square one. And how do we square this circle? Like, it feels really frustrating because we're just having this, like, there's study after study after study to see if it's feasible or not. And then we had a referendum on whether or not we should have amalgamation. And everybody...
We've had two referendums now.
Sure. And like, everyone except, Oak Bay and Langford voted in favor of it. And it's like, what are we doing? Like, we're having the same debates for decades. It's like, that's almost longer than I've been alive. How do we fix this?
It's true. And I think it goes even further back than that. I've seen newspaper articles from 100 years ago talking about amalgamation.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
We were right then.
Yeah. And it's, it's perennial. So I think there is progress on all of these things. The sewage treatment, I invite you all to come, and anyone, all your listeners across the globe, to come and swim in sewage-free waters as of 2021.
Wait, though. Just...
Give it a little bit.
You just need one or two tide changes and we'll be fine. Amalgamation, it's a tricky one. There's Saanich and Victoria moving forward with a citizens' assembly on it. What I like about this is that it's residents leading it. It's not politicians.
Okay, yeah.
And... what I don't like about it is it's just Victoria and Saanich. But I think when you get the two largest municipalities in the region, if we did decide to move forward, then it would be very hard for Esquimalt and Oak Bay and other smaller jurisdictions to stay out.
My prediction for the future is eventually all the other municipalities amalgamate except for Oak Bay. They just refuse to take part.
We could build
forever.
We could build a literal tartan curtain, like a wall, and they wouldn't notice. Oh, what's that? How long's that been there for?
The problem is they haven't been taking care of their underground infrastructure. So eventually it may be appealing for them to join and have some of that burden lifted, but we'll see.
Well, I mean, the one major point in favor of amalgamation is that it's going to make it a lot easier to go to the province or go to the federal government with a funding request and say, this is what we want as a city, instead of having them deal with 13 separate, ambassadors or whatever.
For sure. We'll be at the, we'd be federally at the big city mayor's caucus all of a sudden.
At the big boys table?
We'd have a voice. Right now, the city of Victoria, we're a pretty small municipality. We have an outsized voice because we're the
downtown core.
We're the downtown core and we're the capital city of the province. And this is where the legislature is. So we do have an outsized voice, but we don't have outsized funding. We don't have an outsized ability to actually take action. And then the last thing you mentioned was the transit. And Funnily enough, I just came from a CRD meeting, Capital Regional District, where we were talking about the province's transportation plan for the South Island. And that I feel like that plan could have come forward a decade ago or 2 decades ago or 3 decades ago. It's all the same solutions, still with no funding attached. And so I'm hopeful for real action. But as you mentioned, the bus lanes, they actually have increased ridership on public transit from Langford to Victoria by 45%.
Oh, wow.
And it's only half done.
Well, they have to, because that's where people are moving. Like, that's the... Yeah. Where it's a proper large city that needs a network that isn't just a bunch of...
It's the only place in this area that you can actually, like, a young family can afford a home.
Yeah,
so, of course,
well, that or Souk, right? And Souk is, like... I don't remember the exact route you have to take, but it's like 3 different buses to actually get there. So,
and that's the interesting thing, right? We're pushing for regional free transit for youth regionally, but the mayor of Souk and others, they say, well, why would I want to pay for that when we don't even have buses that come out here? It's a fair point.
Yeah,
Sure. But the real question is, do we want to keep investing in expanding highways?
No, we don't.
Yeah, or would we rather put that money into public transit, into active transportation, and low GHG emitting types of transportation? And to me, the answer is obvious.
Well, you know, recently on Twitter, I saw a friend of the show, Ian Bushfield from the Politico's podcast. He's having a debate with someone about where the next SkyTrain line expansion should be. And I felt so inadequate. It's like, here are these guys in Vancouver are talking about the next shiny, amazing SkyTrain expansion with their, like, world-class...
A mass transit system in the sky. Look to and wonder at.
And, like... You know, and we got our, like, rinky-dink double-decker buses. You know, I feel...
Painting a white diamond on the road is a big deal.
It's like, do you think at any point in the future we'll ever have, you know... And I went to Portland recently, and their train network is amazing. It is incredible. Like, you can just... When you get out at the airport, there's just a train right there, and you can just take it to wherever you want in the city. Do you think there is a future in Victoria at any point for light rail, dare I say a SkyTrain or anything so ambitious, or are we just stuck with buses forever?
So I think we need to finish the bus lane first.
Okay.
Because it only goes halfway.
Fair enough.
You know, the city, Victoria, we finished our part. Saanich has done theirs, and then it stops. So I think finishing that, and then once that's done, you have a corridor that... The long-term vision of that corridor is for LRT. And so it's wide enough that, and then you can put LRT in the middle of that road all the way up Douglas, up the highway. And so it is a step in the right direction. We also have the ENN corridor, which is the Esquimalt Nanaimo Railway currently completely unused.
For anyone outside of Victoria, it's kind of hard to explain, but it's an actual, like diesel locomotive rail line that is just sort of there right now.
But the hard part of building a new rail line is getting the land, right? Is assembling a corridor when you have to expropriate houses or the backs of properties the whole way through a neighborhood. We already have it. It's sitting there. It's been there since the time of colonization when they finished the railway. And it's actually the actual corridor is co-owned by 14 First Nations. And there's, you know, I think it's worthy of investment. But instead we study.
Well, I mean, is the issue that, like, the province isn't willing to pony up the funds and the city is already juggling
their power goes literally to the, like, just a little bit past the bridge.
we didn't even build the bridge, new bridge with railroads. So now it doesn't even come to downtown.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It barely would have its terminus in Victoria West, but municipalities, like we have someone on the board through the CRD, but really it does need to be the province that ponies up and pays for it. And it's just, I think it never rises to that, like that priority level where it gets funded, and it rises high enough priority level to get studied. Mm. You're like, oh yeah, that is worth looking
again
at.
And again, but, and again.
But
something should be done with the ENN. Something. So just sort of as we're kind of getting to the end here, you know, we talked a lot about a fair number of positives, a lot of negatives, you know, kind of the limitations and the problems of municipal politics, I guess. What advice would you give to anyone listening about, like, how to actually get involved in this kind of stuff? Because I know plenty of people who sort of are a bit frustrated at the way their city might be, but they don't know. What do you do? What do you get involved in? How do you get yourself involved in this?
Well, I think people need to, you just need to make the leap at some point. And so if you're someone that has been working on issues in your community or in your neighborhood for a while, then maybe you should just run. And when you run, knock on every door in the city and have those conversations. And if you don't win the first time, maybe you win the next time. And if you're someone who's frustrated about politics, or you're wanting to see social and environmental justice, but you don't know how to get involved, just find an organization that's working on something you're passionate about. And if there's not an organization working on what you're passionate about, then just find one friend who will work on it with you, and go and knock on doors, or go start a petition, or go, you know, hold a little rally, and you'll meet the people who are interested in the same thing as you, and that can be a powerful experience. And so I really think that you know, people find meaning through online organizing, but I think when you're meeting face to face, that can build a new level of engagement. And so I encourage people to make that leap.
Okay, so final bonus question for you.
Bonus.
This is from Anthony, our co-host, who was not able to attend today. So he asks, Jeremy, before I knew you as a local politician, I knew you as a poet and organizer of poetry workshops for youth. Can you say a little bit about this work and what you take the connection between poetry and politics to be?
Happy to. Yeah, so I still consider myself a poet, and I still run Victorious Voices, which is a youth program through spoken word poetry. We go into high schools, do workshops, and then we build up to a festival that happens every April. We're in our 11th year now, and I think it's amazing. It's a chance for young people to speak their truth about whatever things they're going through, whatever issues they're facing, or things they're passionate about. And that, I think the connection is that for me, providing that platform for other people's voices to be heard is the same thing that I try to do at city council, is especially voices that have been traditionally left out or not as valued. And so whether that's, you know, at a poetry event or, you know, a renter's vote initiative, trying to get people whose voices have traditionally undervalued at the table. And through Victoria's Voices, I always guilt trip community leaders to come and watch, especially people who are making decisions about young people's lives and the programs that are supposed to help them. And so try to get them in the room so that they can hear firsthand what some of these young people are going through, and see that performed in a way that's powerful and a way that's deeply moving. And so that I see a lot of connections. People, when I ran, people would often joke. They'd say, "Oh, are you gonna debate in poems?" And it's like, no, but I did once. And it was at the Association of Vancouver Island and Coastal Communities, which is where all the local governments on the island debate policy that we then lobby the province with. And so at that conference, I was introducing a resolution on the right to a healthy environment. And so it's actually calling for constitutional change to enshrine environmental rights. And I introduced that motion through a spoken word poem. And it's quite a energetic poem. And they, so I, the chair of the meeting was trying to shut it down, was trying to figure out, like, I could see him flipping through his pages being like, oh, this must be against some sort of rule, but it's not, I'm just talking. And then so at the end, I do poetry slam. So I know that my poem is exactly 3 minutes long, and because that's your time limit there. And that was also the time limit for the debate. And so it worked out.
What
and,
a happy coincidence. Yeah,
and so then at the end, I got, you know, a half room standing ovation and the other half of the room sitting there with their arms crossed looking like, who is this guy? And what is he doing here? And so I immediately found my allies, because the people who liked it and agreed with the message and with the, you know, the shaking things up in a very staid environment, you know, I was able to meet them right away and find my allies across the island who I've continued to work with on social and environmental justice issues. So
that's rad. That's really rad.
That's very cool.
Well, I think that about wraps it up. Jeremy Loveday, thank you so much for being on the show. This was a great interview. I learned a lot. I will be, I don't know if the Victoria City Council has a avenue for this, but I might just find myself drafting up a citizen's bill to expropriate View Towers.
I look forward to it.
Did you have any
citizen's bill? Can be called a letter to the editor.
Okay, yeah. I dig it. Did you have any final thoughts before we finish up?
No, just thanks for having me on. I enjoyed the conversation, and if anyone is serious about jumping in the ring of electoral politics, reach out to me.
Awesome. Thanks again, Jeremy. And just as a final, don't forget to like and subscribe, etc., etc.
Hit that bell.
Yeah. We're our website's outofleftfield.ca. You can find us on Twitter. If you have a couple minutes to spare, please do leave a glowing review on iTunes, as that does help. It really helps people find the show. And if you want to support the show, we're on patreon.com/outofleftfieldpodcast. Everybody, thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.